Hey, welcome back. This is Marie Queenie Lyons and Try Me. And I don't know whatever happened to Marie Queenie Lyons. I think she put out one album on a small label back in about 1970. Absolutely fantastic. And then never heard from again, as far as I know, and very little information about her online. If anyone out there knows the whereabouts of Marie Queenie Lyons, get a hold of me through the website strangeplanet.ca. There's a contact page there, strangeplanet.ca, and send me an email. I would love to know. And if you're out there, Marie Queenie Lyons, I would love to hear from you because I just think you're fantastic, and just love to know what's going on in your world. Here's a bizarre story out of Zimbabwe: the mysterious drowning death of two young boys is being blamed on a mermaid attack. You heard me correctly. According to media reports, the strange incident occurred as the children were herding cattle near a dam and spotted the mermaid in the water. Thinking it was a fish, the boys attempted to catch it, but unfortunately they turned out to be the prey, as the creature snatched them and dragged them underwater. Initially, it appears the mermaid was only toying with the children and resurfaced with them while the kids were still alive. However, by that time, their parents had arrived on the scene and inadvertently made the situation more dire when they began crying at their children's misfortune. Seeing their show of emotion, the enraged mermaid allegedly grabbed the boys once again and pulled them beneath the surface of the water, where they met their tragic end. The creature's decision to kill the children is suspected of being because of the tears of their parents. Believe it or not, since local legend states that it is unwise to cry in front of a mermaid, lest one wish to die. While the incredibly strange story might seem like pure fiction, it is being taken seriously by authorities, who have launched an investigation into the drowning deaths and say that the dam has been the site of similar mermaid deaths in the past. Hey, say, did I hear this correctly? I was listening last night, Dave Schrader, of course, doing a wonderful job on Coast to Coast hosting, and I'm pretty sure I heard Dave say that ParanormalDate.com now has 61,000 members. 61,000. That's plenty of fish in the sea, as they say. ParanormalDate.com, it's completely free to join and search. You can use the code GEORGE for a sizable discount if you want to get further involved. The service is also available on free iOS and Android apps. Check out the new companion site as well, ConspiracyDate.com. ParanormalDate.com. Remember, you are not alone. I love that tagline. You are not alone. All right, back to more of my conversation with Don Jeffries, Survival of the Richest, on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Welcome back. Don Jeffries stays with us. Survival of the Richest: How the Corruption of the Marketplace and the Disparity of Wealth Created the Greatest Conspiracy of All. I want to talk about the role of free trade, first of all, and then we'll get into the role of automation, robotics, and so forth. But the free trade agreement, I mean, before we had NAFTA, there was, I guess, sort of the precursor of that, or the initial seed was the Auto Pact. Goes back to about 1965. In Europe, you have the European Union, but that dates back to, I mean, the European Economic Community, I guess, started in 73, but the precursor to that goes back to the early 50s. They wanted to create a common market for coal and steel. So they sort of ramp it up incrementally, but you could see that they were laying the seeds very early on, and they had this idea of these large free trade zones. What role has that played in really the decimation of the middle class, the hollowing out of America?
It's played a huge role. Just to give you one example of the disastrous impact of free trade, prior to 1993, when NAFTA was implemented, America had a $1.6 billion trade surplus with Mexico. By 2010, we had an over $60 billion trade deficit with Mexico. So that's the death, because what happens, I think you can have those kind of trade agreements with other first world nations. Mexico's clearly in a completely different situation. You don't make those kind of trade agreements with Mexico. You don't make trade agreements with a totalitarian society like China. And this is the kind of things that Trump criticized during his campaign, and we'll see. He's not following through on much of anything so far, so I don't really trust him at this point. But, that's the kind of thing. It makes no sense to make those kind of trade deals. It's fine to have imports and so forth, but what has happened is you have opened the door to all our companies going offshore, keeping their profits offshore, moving their factories to Mexico, to Taiwan, wherever, where they can pay slave labor. They don't have to pay. They don't have these regulations. They don't have all the health regulations. They don't have to worry about the safety of their employees. And again, they can pay them pretty much anything they want. They don't have to worry about what they had to pay factory workers here. So obviously, you can see why they do it. I think it's irresponsible. It's unpatriotic. But clearly, these people are globalists. They're not Americans at heart. They're looking to make as much money as possible. But free trade has helped gut American industry completely. I think Donald Trump referred constantly in his campaign to the 70,000 factories that have closed in recent years. And you look at something like Detroit. I mean, Detroit was once, Americana, where all the car factories are now. It's like a bombed out country there. And you can't have that kind of those kind of things happen and still have a first world nation. And you can't, services run ancillary to production. And when you get all the production out of the house, eventually those services are going to go too. But you can't have a country that doesn't make anything. Literally, we don't even make the shoes to put on our feet anymore. I mean, it's crazy. It makes no sense. And I mentioned earlier is that we've always had people that, for whatever reason, they don't have the wherewithal to get a college education, they don't have the money, they just can't buckle down or whatever. But in the past, they had opportunities, like I talked about, working at retail stores, but that you had people that made nice livings just working at factories, being trained. They didn't need certifications or all the things that demand of jobs now. They went and they learned on the job, and they did a good job. And American industry was second to none for all those years, especially during the post-war boom. They had a great lifestyle. They had fantastic benefits. They had viable unions. And these are things that you don't see anymore. All those people, the sons and daughters of those people, still exist. The ones that, especially the ones we're talking about, the 91% that are in the bottom quarter of Americans that obviously aren't going to go to college. Well, where are they going to go? They have to do something. So free trade has really decimated industry. It's left our shores. And if Trump can bring some of those factories back, that would be wonderful. I kind of doubt it, but we have to have something to back America. And production and industry has always backed us, since the Industrial Revolution. And we don't have anything to replace it. And you talked about robotics, and combined with the gutting of industry, combined with the booming robotics revolution, where they're talking about I don't know how many millions of jobs are going to be replaced by artificial intelligence in the few coming decades. And as usual, our leaders are approaching this issue with their customary brilliance. They're doing nothing. I don't just do the math. You already have 94 to 100 million adults, American adults, out of work, and you're going to have untold millions that are going to be thrown out of work, from fast food workers to and it'll all be at the low end of the spectrum. You're not going to have robotic vice presidents looking out the window. You're not going to have any robot CEOs, just like you'll never have any, illegal immigrants.
How could you tell?
Exactly. Yeah, but I mean, really, I think they could have an impact there probably. They could do a much better job. That obviously would be cheaper. But instead, we have, have a kind of joking, Bill Gates joking, saying we can tax the robots. Oh, how can you tax the robots? I guess if you tax the companies, maybe if you put a big enough tax on the companies to discourage them from hiring robots, that might possibly work. It might discourage it. But I think, with the self-driving cars, they're talking about truckers, another industry where you don't need an education for, but you can make a decent living if you're willing to drive cross-country and live that lifestyle. There's probably a lot of them listening to us tonight.
There's a huge driverless vehicle company that's moving into Arizona, and the governor is very happy that it's moving there. But I read recently, and don't quote me on the stat, but it's something like 1 in 5 American jobs are tied to driving.
Yeah.
1 in 5.
Yeah.
What is the upside? What is the upside of doing something like that?
Well, it's everything our leaders do at this point, that's why I say when you mentioned Henry Ford or people like that, even the early, I talk about Milton Hershey and some of those other people like that, even the J.P. Morgans, the Carnegies, the robber barons, and you know the plutocrats of another era, they at least wanted their employees to be relatively happy. Milton Hershey had a bunch of perks for him. I talk about in the book, for instance, and a couple of the early magnates did as well. Now they just want you to be, to be just. They want robots, and I believe that really the gist of all this and the reason why illegal immigration has been so popular is because at heart there's a plantation mentality among that 1%. And they really, really would love to bring slavery back if they could. And I don't mean slavery of African Americans. I'm talking about they want slaves of any kind. And I believe illegal immigrants are as close as they can come to that because they can pay them, you know, under the table. They can pay them pittances. If they drop dead on the job, they can just kind of, you know, sweep them to the curb and they'll have to worry about any questions or any regulations. So it's a great advantage for them. And I can understand why, because they're only driven, unlike the early-day magnates and the early-day capitalists, they're not driven by any kind of civic duty, like Henry Ford, for instance, talked about, I have to pay my workers enough to buy my product. Just makes sense. Nobody thinks that way anymore. All they think about is, how big is my bonus going to be this year? Sure, I have to lay off 50,000 workers, but I'm going to get an even bigger bonus, and that's all they think about. And everyone advising them that is sitting at that table, the vice president's in charge of looking out the window, they're all sharing in the gravy train, too, so they're all getting a lesser amount, but still a tremendous amount compared to the average worker. So are they going to rock the boat and say, hey, you know, JR, you know, we really, this doesn't make sense. You know, we got 15,000 employees and, you know, 14,500 are getting nothing for Christmas, and, you know, we're getting millions. Nobody's going to rock that boat, because to do so, that's the way their bread is buttered. So that's what we're looking at. There's no civic duty. No one. I mean, I have a few examples of people in the book that spoke out a little bit. The CEO of Whole Foods, for instance, tries to tie his salary to his workers. There are a few people out there that are trying to be a little reasonable, but the culture is just so greed driven. There's such a selfishness there, and I think a lot of it has to do with the popularity of Ayn Rand. Still, so many of these people grew up in the 80s reading her books and then the
absolutely.
Culture of greed. It's
amazing how many corporate people cite Ayn Rand as an inspiration.
Yeah.
I think you've nailed it. I think it's
they do.
Toxic influence.
The other thing is,
influence.
Remember that book, Looking Out for Number One, that was a huge bestseller back then. The bumper sticker, He Who Dies with the Most Toys Wins. I mean, there's that mentality there that you see that it's just, you know, how much stuff can I accumulate? And the rest of you be damned. I mean, and that's the way they look at it. They just don't care. You know, sucks for you. I mean, the expressions are endless. You know,
it's almost as if they constitute a breakaway civilization. In the UFO sort of arena, people like Richard Dolan talk about a breakaway civilization. And we're not talking about the 1%. We're talking about the 1% of the 1% who have more money than God, who have perhaps at their disposal all of this technology, free energy devices and so forth, who are basically off planet now. They don't give a damn what happens down here. They have everything they need. They've given up on this world. I'm not suggesting you're going that far, but they do almost constitute a separate civilization.
Yeah, and they just, I think at this point, I don't know, you know, there's so many of them in eugenicists. We have all, I mean, I talked about that in Hidden History quite a bit about the eugenicists, and then the theme we get over and over again that we need to reduce the population, and, you know, joking about eliminating millions or even billions of people, and, you know, getting rid of the riffraff, and there's a belief at the upper levels. They all think this, and they haven't done it yet, thank goodness. They haven't unleashed a plague or anything on that to do it, but that's the way they kind of cavalierly dismiss the what Henry Kissinger termed the what did he call them, the useless
eaters.
Exactly, you know, and that's the way they look at most of us. I think they look at us as useless leaders, and they laugh. They must laugh uproariously at how the vast majority of us continue to fall for the same propaganda, continue to bail them out, and somehow feel empathy for them that they don't feel for their, you know, the poorest people among us, you know, the welfare queens and people like that, that they're always looking at. They're just trained to look in that direction. And over here you have, you know, 100 CEOs that are just stealing millions on the street corner, but they're looking at the, you know, the one welfare queen over there, and what's she doing, you know? What is she getting with those food stamps? And that's the way we're trained to do, and it's not even a left-right issue. It's just the way people are, and that's why the 1% has been so successful, because we just, I mean, we should have, oh, you know, thrown them out on their ear a long time ago, but we can't do anything because our elected representatives are in bed with them. Like I said, without the affluence means influence. If you don't have any affluence, you don't have any influence over those elected representatives. And unfortunately, you know, either the voting process is completely rigged, which I believe it probably is, but however you look at it, or the voting populace is that stupid, but 96% or so of them are reelected every term. And you're never going to have, nothing's ever going to change when you have kind of a smaller turnover than the original Russian Soviet Politburo. You can't have any kind of change, and that's what I talk about not having anybody in the public eye that has any kind of public platform. No one is concerned about issues. I mean, I'm a lone voice crying in the wilderness. I mean, there are other people that believe as I do, but there's nobody with a public platform that is going out there and saying, we have to do something. There's no Huey Long. And as you know, I devoted a chapter to Huey Long in my book. And
yes.
He's my political hero. We need another Huey Long. We need a share of wealth society. And unfortunately, there's nobody today. Bernie Sanders is nowhere near Huey Long. He touched on it a little bit, but Huey Long wouldn't have wanted to raise the payroll taxes, which was going to raise the taxes of the lowest paid workers. You know, he wanted to soak the absolute 1%, and that's who needs to be soaked, because that's where the money is. And if you're ever going to raise the standard of living of the great mass of people, you have to take the money from those who have it, and those who have it are at the absolute top, the 1% of the 1%, as you said.
But even if you took everything from the top of the 1%, that's not even going to, you know, scratch the surface of a $20 trillion debt.
Well, no, but I look at the debt, and I talk about that in the book, too. I don't call it our debt because it's banker debt. It's largely imaginary. It's so much of it is interest, which should be repudiated because the interest can never be repaid because it was created in thin air, just as 90% of the principal was under our fractional lending system. I would repudiate the debt. And I would stop trying to blame the taxpayers. I mean, politicians try to guilt us on, you know, we have to do something about the debt because our children's children. Well, we didn't sign on to this debt. You know, I didn't want China to, you know, I didn't want to borrow money from China. All the crazy stuff that we have assuming and without the Federal Reserve ever being audited. I mean, they just did a very small audit a few years ago, the Federal Reserve, and they found, I don't know how many trillions it was they had found that they had doled out to big corporations and banks and so forth. So imagine what a full audit, which is one of the many promises Donald Trump made, which I don't expect him to keep, but if there was a full audit of the Federal Reserve, it would be unbelievable. You talk about this, seeing the sausage being made, but I think it would go a long way to exposing exactly how fraudulent that debt is. The Fed's been monetizing the debt for a long time, and it's largely imaginary. Most people in the public think, well, you know, we're spending more than we're taxing, and that's not it. There's interest on it which should be repudiated and can never be repaid, and there's these banker shenanigans which we have nothing to do with. And if we had an honest money system and that this private corporation, the Fed, running everything, then we wouldn't have these kind of problems. But again, it's the people at the top, and there's nobody trying to rein this stuff in because it's in a position to do anything is profiting from the system. So they're not going to rock the boat because even though 80% of us, it's not working well for the people at the top, it's working great for. So they love the system.
Well, sometimes you drain the swamp and sometimes the swamp drains you, I guess. It's all starting to look a little like H.G. Wells was right. When you go back to the time machine and you had the Morlocks and the Eloi, I think that's what he was talking about, was the advanced stages of capitalism when you had these people living on the surface. They were basically, you know, fodder for the Morlocks living underneath who were controlling everything. It's a pretty bleak picture, and we'll find out if there's any way out from underneath all of this when my conversation with Donald Jeffries continues. The book is Survival of the Richest, How the Corruption of the Marketplace and the Disparity of Wealth Created the Greatest Conspiracy of All. Very quickly, Donald, how can people get a copy of the book?
Well, it's published by Skyhorse. That's my publisher, so they can go to the publisher. And it's on Amazon. It's not going to be published, actually released until July 4th of all dates, but it has been available for pre-order on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and it will be in Barnes & Noble bookstores, I'm sure, once it gets actually published. But people can pre-order it now. I think it's at a little lower rate on Amazon and maybe on Barnes & Noble, but it's in all the usual places. If you
Excellent.
Google it online, you'll find it a bunch of, with the publisher, Amazon, wherever, and then you can wait and buy it at the bookstore if you want to down the road.
All right, Donald, stay with us. James Carr, I'm a fool for you, taking us into the break on Coast to Coast AM. Glitty, glub, gloopy, nibby, nabby, noopy, la, la, lolo, sabba, sibby, sabba. Well, it ain't Noel Coward, but it ain't bad. Good morning, sunshine. And that's the lovely Canadian chanteuse Serena Ryder's edition, or rendition of that song, which was written for the musical Hair back in the late 1960s. NASA's Hubble Space Telescope snapped some shots of Jupiter as our solar system's largest planet made its closest approach to Earth in a year, a mere 415 million miles away. That's a mere hop, skip, and a jump, really. The spectacular views include the Great Red Spot, a massive storm cycle that is larger than the Earth itself and has swirled for at least 150 years. Also on view is what has been dubbed Red Spot Jr., a smaller storm to the right that has been intensifying over the years. Again, Lex Lonehood, our webmaster tonight, has posted that up at the coasttocoastam.com website in the highlights section. Join Coast to Coast AM's George Norrie for dynamic discussions on paranormal phenomena, conspiracies, and all things unexplained. Beyond Belief TV. There's an upcoming episode Wednesday, April the 12th, Journey to the Akashic Records with Bill Foss. Look across lifetimes to gain a deeper understanding of who you are. And you can check out some of the best episodes of Beyond Belief. It's real easy. Just go to beyondbelief.com. All right, back to more of my conversation with Don Jeffries, author of Survival of the Richest, and we'll also take your questions and comments when Coast to Coast AM continues in just moments. Welcome back. Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast to Coast AM's web affiliate in Toronto, Talk Radio AM 640. I want to get to some calls here before we get back into our conversation, Donald. On the wild card line, Mike is in Ventura, California. Mike, good morning and welcome.
Hi, Richard. Hey, this is Mike from Ventura, and I'm honored to be on your show. I'd like to tell you, Richard, you're a great American. I'm in Ventura, but you're still America, right? You're North America.
Well, and, I'm a Canadian, although I suppose philosophically and emotionally I'm a little bit American, yes.
Yeah, you're definitely North American, and I just called to thank your I'm a spokesman and advocate for the homeless, and I speak at city council meetings halfway across the nation from Missouri to and all points in between from California. And I just wanted to thank your guest for all the hard work and study that he's put into what he's doing here in behalf of all the poor people and low-income people and homeless people across this nation and throughout the world. I just want to say we appreciate what you're doing. And that's the comment that I want to make, and I don't want to take up too much of your time. I just wanted to comment and thank you for the work, the hard work and study that you're doing. Thank you, sir.
All right. Well, there you go, Donald. A nice comment from Mike and Ventura.
Yeah, that's very nice. I thank him for all the great work he's doing.
He mentioned being an advocate for the homeless, and I wanted to talk to you about we go back to 1964 and LBJ's declared war on poverty. And since that time, United States government, I don't know if it's all levels of government or just the federal government, have spent something like $22 trillion on various welfare type programs. It's not getting any better. I mean, that's not obviously the solution to throw money at the problem.
That's why I would urge readers to read my chapter on Huey Long in this book, because That's the way to solve it, and it will be populism, not establishment liberalism. LBJ's plan is a typical big government bureaucracy, and as you know, it didn't work. And this kind of war is just like the war on drugs has been a complete failure. The war on poverty obviously was a complete failure. And you have to do what you have to. There's only a finite amount of money, and if all the people at the top are hoarding the vast majority of the money, it has to come from there, unless you're just going to become a printing press and print it for everyone, which no one wants to do. So you have to distribute it and let it, Reagan's great trickle-down theory, if it trickled down really fast and kept flowing down and gathering steam, then something like that might work. But there is no trickle-down, obviously, and there wasn't that, and there isn't now. You have to get the money from those who have it, and that's what Huey Long wanted to do, and that's why everyone from the right to the Communist and the Socialist Party, I have the quotes from them in the book, and obviously all the liberal Democrats who should help him, he should be their hero, because he actually did. I have the statistics that I got through the website that's run by Huey Long's great-granddaughter, who I've established a relationship with. She's a wonderful person. She's trying to carry along Huey Long's legacy, and you can see the tangible results that he got, which is unlike a Lyndon Johnson or Bill Clinton or Barack Obama or any of the modern-day liberal Democrats. I mean, he cut everyone's utility bill by a good amount. You know, he stopped foreclosures. You know, he did things like that. He invented adult education. He invented free textbooks for the children. He invented medical and psychiatric care for prisoners. He had a bunch of free health clinics. He was probably one of the first people that would wanted a single-payer system, which I think is the only way we can solve the health crisis in this country. But again, nobody wants to do it, even though I think the majority of the people in polls want it. But
we've got a single-payer situation up here. The problem is you have a single-payer, single provider. There are only two other countries on the planet that use that scheme. One is North Korea. The other is Cuba. And Canada's in the same boat, and I can tell you, it's not sustainable.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you about whether, aside from globalization, which you could say, well, that's just kind of it's more of a random approach to this problem, but. Whether to me, it almost seems like there's some strip mining going on. There's a deliberate attempt to suck the wealth out of the country, and then at a certain point, when you've sucked everything dry, you move your base of operation offshore. Maybe it's to the Far East. I don't know. Is there some of that going on?
Sure. I mean, the statistics, Apple, all the other big companies, they keep an untold amount offshore, and again, it's to avoid taxes, and it's again everything. They basically outsourced industry. So if they move their factory to Mexico or Taiwan or wherever, their operating costs are so much less than they would be here, and that's all they care about. They don't have that civic responsibility that we talked about, where in the old days they would think, well, I'm throwing Americans out of work. They don't care. To them, they're just, you're just pieces on a chessboard. I'm getting rid of thousands of people, and they don't think that the thousands of people they're laying off very often right before the holidays, it's kind of a Merry Christmas present to them. But when they do that, they don't think of the thousands of people that are impacted on their families, their children, and so forth, and what effect it has on their communities and certainly on their individual lives. They don't look at them as human beings, much as the person that was working with the homeless. We to the point where we don't look at the homeless a lot of times as human beings. I discuss in my chapter on hating the poor, where it's you have people that film fights among the homeless. They'll just go up and beat the homeless up, and you have homelessness. They're trying to make the homelessness illegal in certain areas. It's like you have to be somewhere, and if you don't have a shelter. And I know at least in Great Britain, I don't know how many empty homes we have in America, but in Great Britain they talked about how they had, I don't know how many, an incredible number of vacated homes. Now, if we had leaders with foresight, which we don't, but if we did have leaders that were creative, and they could come up with some kind of a plan or some kind of program to put the homeless in those homes that have been vacated, where they have dwellings, or even vacated office buildings that have sat empty, as in different parts of the country, that's what's happening. Is there aren't the startup businesses, no matter what the myth is. 7% of the business in America are small businesses. And most people, it's just very hard to do, and 90% of them fail within the first year. So there's lots of empty office buildings, lots of empty spaces. They could come up with a creative way to have places for people to stay, and not just the homeless shelters. But
I agree. I agree.
We prefer to just, you know, kick them on the street and say, move along, you know, go somewhere that have nowhere to go, but just, you know, go away.
Unfortunately, I think one of the things that's happened, Don, is, and I'm not suggesting that Mike and Ventura is of this ilk, far from it, but there has become this homeless advocacy industry. And, you know, they lobby the city hall for more money for these shelters and so forth. You go into these shelters, from my understanding, and I've talked to city councilors, they're empty, by and large, but they want more beds, and they're empty because homeless people don't want to go there. They're not safe. They're not clean. But this advocacy industry just keeps sucking money and throwing it, just not unlike LBJ's war on poverty, keep throwing money at it. It's just good money chasing bad money. It's never going to solve the problem.
I'm sure they've grown wealthy in poverty. As I said, with all the money we spent on it since LBJ's war on poverty, obviously we should have seen a great deal of improvement. And the fact we haven't shows that the money and the resources aren't being directed in the, you know, channeled in the right direction. And we see this internationally. I talk about Live Aid, you know, Sir Bob Geldof's scheme back in 1985, where the money didn't go to, and that's why Hubert Long was so important. He wanted to give the money directly to people. He didn't want to create a program. The money didn't go to the starving children in Ethiopia. Instead, it went to the warlords or the corrupt people in those countries. And that's why, you know, a few years later, they were talking about the exact same problem. And that's what happens if you don't give it. And that's why I'm a populist, like Huey Long was. And he wanted to, you know, look, nobody can have more than $10 million. That was back in the 30s, which would be like, what, $200 million or something. Now, nobody needs more than $200 million. That's ridiculous. But he just wanted to put a cap on that, and that way the money would be, and I believe he had the first $1 million of income back in the 1930s, and that would be like, what, $50 million or whatever it would be today, was tax-free. So he was going after the absolute top, the 1% of the 1%, which is the problem, and that's who. And these programs of LBJ's or any of the liberal Democrat, they're not going after the absolute top. They're taxing primarily middle class or, you know, maybe upper middle class people. Their taxes are going to go up. And maybe a tiny bit of benefits and that really no one can live off of go to some people. But once with the Welfare Reform Act under Bill Clinton, again, under Liberal Democrat Bill Clinton, in a chapter on that, where welfare is not what it was. You don't get what you used to get, and you get less money for a lot shorter period of time now, thanks to the reforms under Liberal Bill Clinton.
All right, let's go to the wild card line. Chris is in Raleigh, North Carolina. Chris, good morning. Welcome.
Hi. I'm wondering, is this ever going to lead to a war or maybe collapse of America?
Civil war, class war? What do you say, Don?
A collapse of our country.
Well, I think as I write in the book, I think we've been experiencing class warfare for pretty much of human history, and it's been the rich that have been waging war on the rest of us. And whenever anyone like me wants to fight back a little bit and mention it, well, that's class warfare, that's class envy. Well, we ought to be envious. So, you know, when someone is getting $700,000 a month to retire, and the average American worker is making $44,000 with no hope of any kind of pension and really retirement becoming a pipe dream, there's reason to be not envious, but angry. And so, class warfare, unfortunately, we need to wage a little class warfare because we have to point the fingers at the people who are profiting from the system and then, you know, stop blaming people who don't have anything.
And again, you're not pointing fingers at the 1% that makes $250,000, which is sort of the minimum annual income. I mean, $250,000, let's say, for a family of five, you're trying to put your kids through college, that's not obscene wealth. You're talking about the 1% of the 1% that have more money than God.
Right. When you're doing things like buying your own island or buying a castle in Scotland that you go to once every 5 years, those kind of things where you don't – you have more money than you know what to do with. Well, you know, no one should have more money than they can spend or know what to do with. as Huey Long describes it, more money than they can spend, or their children can spend, and their children's children can spend. That's what we need to. There's no need to be that kind of, have that kind of greed and selfishness. Let's share the wealth.
Toby is in Augusta, Maine. Good morning, Toby. Welcome to Coast AM.
Good morning, guys. I agree with a lot of what you say. I just have a couple of questions. As far as the banker bailout goes, you know, we can obviously agree that that's a greed and misuse of taxpayer funds. But when you have a welfare mom, you know, living it up better than someone who works, can't we agree that that's also greed and misuse of middle-class taxpayer funds? And my next question was, as far as the minimum wage goes, when we raise minimum wage, to me it's the Walmarts of the world that win because they can afford to pay it while the small and mid-businesses get shut out. And do you have any sympathy for those businesses that are in the middle? And one last question was, if you look at any forest, none of the trees are the same height. Do you believe that one day all people will have the same amount of money, or do you believe it's ever happened in history or ever will?
Good questions all, Toby. All right.
I'm not a socialist. This may sound like a socialist scheme, but I just want a little more fairness. And, I don't think the trees are ever going to be the same height. And I don't, you know, human skills differ. Human ability to save money, to be reckless with it, to be responsible with it. Obviously, it differs. But no one should have to be destitute. As Huey Long talked about, everyone should have a place to stay. They should have the at least the bare necessities of life. And no one needs to have the kind of sinful wealth that the people, the 1% of the 1% have. As for the small business, we talked about the small business thing, certainly I don't want to tie small businesses up with really a hard enough time succeeding as it is. 90% or so of them fail in the first year. And again, only 7% of Americans make their money by running a small business. So it's largely overstated because the politicians that talk about it want to appeal to make it seem as if they're not, lobbying for big corporations when they are. So they keep talking about small business, which really is not much of a factor because, unfortunately, it's harder and harder to keep a business these days. So I understand what you're saying about the minimum wage, but the minimum wage argument, usually what we hear is that if we raise the minimum wage, the products, everything's going to cost more. We have to, well, if that's true, then aren't your products going up in price when you're paying these people like Al Gore ridiculous amounts of money to sit on and to attend four meetings, or giving somebody a $40 million golden parachute, or giving John Welch $400 and some million? Why don't the prices rise commensurate with that? Somehow that doesn't affect. Their bonus is going up, but if we give the people flipping burgers or the people sweeping the floors, if we give them, 50 cents more an hour, everything's going to come crashing down, and those costs will be eaten by the consumer. So I think it's largely rhetoric, and again, it's just trying to maintain this untenable system so they redirect. And what you talked about the welfare cheats, there are welfare cheats. Certainly there are people milking the system, but the degree to which they can milk the system is really controlled. They can't get that much money no matter how hard they cheat.
All right, Don, I've got to jump in here, and we'll take a time out, come back. I'd like to hear more about the Kingfisher, Huey Long, as well. I know you write about him extensively in Survival of the Richest, and we'll do right just that when we come back. Here's Solomon Burke, the great Solomon Burke, taking us into the break with Fast Train here on Coast to Coast AM.